to be murdered. In short, the CIA did everything possible to ensure Lumumba's death. In the process, they formed an alliance with Joseph Mobutu, who became a loyal ally of the United States and one of history's most repellent dictators. For 3 decades, Mobutu ruthlessly governed his renamed country, Zaire, casually murdering political opponents and amassing a personal fortune in one of the world's poorest nations. This, too, is a legacy of the age of Eisenhower. 3. Coming in the middle of a high-spirited presidential campaign, the tumult in Central Africa did not attract much national attention from the American press. Cuba mattered far more to Americans, and the loss of the Caribbean island to communism became one of Kennedy's most potent themes in the 1960 campaign. Kennedy argued that the loss of Cuba revealed a broader failure of American verve and determination in waging the Cold War. The United States, he asserted, had fallen behind, while the communist bloc had surged ahead. "There is no disputing the fact," he said in Portland, Oregon, brimming with confidence, "that our prestige, our stature, and our influence have all declined during the 1950s. There was a lack of respect around the world for America. The country had entered a period of decline and needed to move with vigor to restore its flagging influence." Cuba offered a painful example of the consequences of inaction. Communism has expanded to within 90 miles of the coast of the United States, 8 minutes by jet from the coast of Florida, Kennedy charged in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Yet Eisenhower had done nothing. In Raleigh, North Carolina, Kennedy denounced the drift and complacency of the administration. "We talked tough when the people of Hungary revolted, but Khrushchev crushed the revolt. We talked tough when communism began to grow in Cuba, but Cuba is a communist satellite today." Kennedy's muscular anti-communist rhetoric might well have come from the lips of Barry Goldwater. Eisenhower greeted these accusations with sardonic reserve. Far from tolerating communism in Cuba, his administration had been preparing since March 1960 a major covert operation to infiltrate guerrilla fighters into Cuba to destabilize Castro's regime. In the spring, the CIA had started training Cuban guerrillas in Guatemala and had set up the Revolutionary Democratic Front, a coalition of anti-communist factions that would replace Castro. In April, the Navy began construction of a medium-wave radio station on Swan Island for broadcasting anti-Castro news into Cuba. It went live in May. In July, the United States announced a halt to purchases of Cuban sugar, a massive blow to the island's economy designed to put more pressure on Castro. And in August, Bissell enlisted key leaders of the American Mafia in a plot to assassinate Castro in conjunction with the guerrilla infiltration plan. Far from doing nothing about Castro, the Eisenhower White House devoted immense energy to developing ways of destroying him. And Eisenhower pushed the pace. On August 18th, the same day that he allegedly called for the murder of Lumumba, Eisenhower met with Dulles, Bissell, Gray, and other top security advisors and approved a significant increase in the budget for the anti-Castro plan. Initial funds for the operation amounted to $2.5 million. Bissell now asked for an additional $10.75 million. This dramatic increase reveals the growing ambition of the project. Originally designed to place small teams of saboteurs and guerrillas into Cuba, Bissell's scheme had grown dramatically. It now envisioned a paramilitary strike force placed on Cuban shores by an amphibious landing, equipped with air power and heavy weapons, that would provide more muscle to the infiltrated guerrilla fighters once their subversion efforts got underway. Gray supported Bissell's expansive ideas, and Eisenhower approved both the funds and the backup force. The minutes of the meeting show that Eisenhower spoke firmly about his eagerness to move ahead. He said he would defend this kind of action against all comers, and that if we were sure of freeing the Cubans from this incubus, $25 million might be a small price to pay. During the fall of 1960, the Cuba issue came right to Ike's doorstep. On September 20th, the United Nations General Assembly convened in New York City. This gathering possessed special significance, as the UN planned to admit no fewer than 14 new nations, all former colonies of Western empires. The world body was quite literally changing its complexion, and by 1960 it stood ready to become the tribune of the non-white world, an amplifier of the grievances of millions of newly independent peoples. Held under the glare of intense media attention, this UN meeting offered a priceless opportunity to the great rivals in the Cold War to court the new member states. Soviet Premier Khrushchev arrived in New York at the head of a large delegation to make his pitch. In contrast to his visit a year earlier, when he was Eisenhower's guest, Khrushchev's arrival on September 19th was met with jeers and insults from thousands of protesters, mostly people of Eastern European heritage who denounced Soviet domination of their homelands. Khrushchev did not seem to mind. Still bitter about the U-2 affair in May, he came to New York to turn up the heat in the Cold War, inflame the sedate halls of the United Nations, and woo the Third World. Khrushchev, though, had to share the spotlight. Thrilled at the chance to grab his own share of world publicity, Fidel Castro arrived in New York on September 18th amid a flurry of demonstrations and counter-demonstrations. A natural propagandist, Castro milked the trip for all it was worth. From the opening hour of his visit, he caused commotion. Taken to a bourgeois midtown hotel, he and his entourage refused the demand of hotel management that they post a $10,000 deposit against any damages or expenses that his bearded, fatigue-wearing revolutionaries might incur. Instead, he stalked out and moved his delegation to the Hotel Teresa on 125th Street and 7th Avenue, in the heart of Harlem. This location, a well-known hub of black cultural life in New York, offered Castro a perfect stage from which to denounce the segregation and racism of American society. Holding court at the Teresa, Castro gleefully reached out to Harlem's African-American residents, who, he suggested, shared more with Cubans than they did with white Americans. Malcolm X, a prominent leader of the Nation of Islam, met with him briefly, after which Castro professed solidarity with the black struggle in America and around the world. "We are all brothers," he declared in accented English. Cuban officials strolling through the neighborhood praised Harlem for its democratic atmosphere and said, "It's like Havana." Not to be outdone in the pursuit of press coverage, Khrushchev decided to pay Castro an unannounced visit on September 20th, racing his black limousine and large police escort all the way uptown to Castro's hotel. Thousands of spectators had crowded the hotel's entrance, which was guarded by a ring of steely, blue-clad New York City police. Inside, Khrushchev met Castro in a ninth-floor suite, emerging after 20 minutes with a grin, declaring Castro a heroic man. Savvy observers of the Castro-Khrushchev encounter at the Hotel Teresa understood its significance. Jackie Robinson, the former baseball star and civil rights leader, said the meeting of the two communist leaders shows the concern they both have regarding the new African countries and of segregation and discrimination in the United States. Robinson called on the U.S. government to send more aid to Africa and to dismantle Jim Crow at home. James L. Hicks, editor of the venerable black newspaper Amsterdam News, phrased the issue more pointedly. "Fidel Castro stuck a knife into the heart of America's race problem Monday night, and Nikita Khrushchev broke it off at the hilt Tuesday morning." Later in the day, when both men arrived at the UN headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, they embraced in a bear hug in front of dozens of popping flashbulbs. Pictures of this abrazo appeared in all the world's newspapers the next day. It was a particularly delicious moment for Khrushchev, who believed he had drawn the charismatic revolutionary into his orbit and successfully poked President Eisenhower in the eye. Eisenhower, meanwhile, conducted a rather more sedate and regal charm offensive of his own during this extraordinary week in New York. On September 22nd, he gave a solemn speech to the General Assembly, praising the human yearning for self-determination, stating America's desire for peaceful relations with all nations, and calling on the great powers to commit far more money to the economic development of the newly independent African nations. He invited the heads of 18 Latin American countries for lunch, deliberately leaving Castro out. In the afternoon, in a counterpoint to Castro's outreach efforts, he welcomed leading figures of the non-aligned movement to his suite at the Waldorf Astoria, then one of the world's most glamorous hotels, and a far cry from Castro's digs in Harlem. He met with Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and Josip Tito of Yugoslavia. Later in the week, he hosted President Nasser of Egypt and also met with Prime Minister Nehru. The conversations were not substantial, but the symbolism mattered enormously. Ike understood, no less than Castro and Khrushchev, that the United States needed friends among the emerging nations of the Third World. By appealing to these moderate and influential men of the non-aligned movement, Eisenhower hoped to limit the propaganda value to the communist bloc of the Castro-Khrushchev embrace. But for all of Ike's efforts, the week surely belonged to Castro. In his extraordinary 3-hour address to the General Assembly on September 26th, Castro gave the world a history lesson of the kind that Americans had rarely heard. He spoke about American colonization and exploitation of Cuba. He thundered about the degradation and suffering of the Cuban people at the hands of the U.S.-backed Batista dictatorship. He pointed an accusing finger at the U.S. government for its radio propaganda station based in Swan Island, an embarrassing revelation, and invoked the fate of Guatemala to remind his listeners of the consequences of agrarian reforms that threatened U.S. business interests. And he held out Cuba as an example to the world of how to throw off the shackles of colonial servitude. To the delegations from Asia and Africa, Castro's words seemed like lightning bolts in a dark sky. 4. The extraordinary events at the United Nations formed the backdrop to the first of the Nixon-Kennedy televised debates. Senator Kennedy understood how to exploit the anxiety that Khrushchev and Castro had provoked. Although the first debate, on the evening of September 26th, focused on domestic issues, Kennedy's opening remarks invoked Khrushchev's menacing presence in New York and spoke darkly of a communist offensive going on around the world. The great question of the age, Kennedy suggested, was whether America was strong enough to counter that offensive. Nixon did a poor job that evening in rebutting these charges. He had recently been ill, had lost weight, and looked tired. His makeup streaked, and his stubbly chin glistened with sweat. All agreed that Kennedy won the first round, going away. Kennedy kept up the pressure. On the eve of the second debate, in a speech in Cincinnati, he called Eisenhower's Cuba policy a glaring failure. America had backed the dictator Batista, he said, prompting such despair among the Cuban people that they fell for the seduction of a communist revolutionary. Now Castro threatens the security of the whole Western Hemisphere. When the second debate opened on October 7th, Kennedy beat the drum of American decline, alleging that the United States had been standing still while the communists surged. Nixon, more poised, better prepared, and less sickly-looking than in his debut, replied sharply. He scolded Kennedy for such defeatist talk and for running down the Great Republic. He pointed to the advances the communist bloc made under Truman when 600 million people went behind the Iron Curtain, and asserted that Eisenhower had turned back the red tide. "We have stopped them at Quemoy and Matsu. We have stopped them in Indochina. We have stopped them in Lebanon," Nixon crowed. Nixon's boasts about the defense of Quemoy during the second debate drew Kennedy into an attack on Eisenhower's handling of the defense of Taiwan. Kennedy alleged that American policy there was fuzzy and confused and had therefore invited Chinese provocation. He preferred to draw a line, stating clearly that America would not risk war over Quemoy and Matsu. "I think it is unwise," he said in a memorable blunder, "to take the chance of being dragged into a war which may lead to a world war over two islands which are not strategically defensible. or essential to the defense of Taiwan. This sounded like Kennedy was advocating retreat under communist pressure, and Nixon pounced. In the third debate on October 13th, Nixon painted Kennedy as an advocate of appeasement toward communist China. Sensing that he had been hurt by Nixon's attacks on the Quemoy issue, Kennedy tried to change the subject. On October 18th, he gave a blistering speech at the American Legion Convention in Miami Beach on the steady erosion of American power. In an address filled with factual inaccuracies and distortions, Kennedy damned the Eisenhower administration for cutting back on missile development, slowing the modernization of the armed forces, failing to develop jet airlift capacity, failing to prepare for conflict abroad. "We have been slipping, and we are moving into a period of danger." The United States needed to show the world that it had the guts for a long, long, hard fight against the communist advance in the 1960s. The day before the final debate, Kennedy struck again, this time on Cuba. He issued a statement that denounced the administration for doing nothing for 6 years and called for the arming of non-Batista democratic anti-Castro forces in exile and in Cuba itself, who offer eventual hope of overthrowing Castro. He asserted, "Thus far, these fighters for freedom have had virtually no support from our government." Did Kennedy know that the United States was in the midst of planning just such a covert operation to overthrow Castro? And if so, did he use this highly secret knowledge to score a debating point and make himself look stronger than Nixon in his desire to oust Castro? Nixon certainly thought so, and wrote with bitterness about the episode in his memoirs. Kennedy had indeed been briefed by Allen Dulles on July 23rd and September 19th on a wide range of intelligence matters, as part of the normal routine of giving major presidential candidates a review of ongoing policies. Nixon assumed that Dulles had filled Kennedy in on the Cuba plans, and that JFK then used this sensitive information to embarrass the administration. It has never been clear, nor is it fully demonstrable, that Dulles gave Kennedy a detailed brief on the Cuba operation, which was still evolving. The two Dulles-Kennedy meetings covered many issues, Cuba being only one. Even so, given Kennedy's excellent contacts on Capitol Hill, in the Defense Department, and in the CIA itself, it seems likely that he had a general idea that the CIA was plotting Castro's ouster by using Cuban exiles. Yet he recklessly attacked the administration for doing nothing to help anti-Castro forces, knowing that Nixon could not affirm the existence of the covert operation. At the very least, it was a cynical move. The issue took a bizarre twist in the fourth debate, on October 21st, when Nixon denounced Kennedy for his dangerously irresponsible proposal of arming Cuban exiles and promoting the overthrow of Castro, the very plan that his own administration was pursuing. Nixon believed he had to differentiate himself from Kennedy, so he argued against the policies he himself had long favored. Ironically, his case against a covert operation to overthrow Castro was so skillful and well delivered, he seemed actually to have carried the point. Intervention in Cuba would alienate world opinion completely, he said, and it would be an open invitation to Khrushchev to come into Latin America. Nixon did as well as he could to develop a sensible, reasoned argument for quarantining Cuba rather than invading it. Yet every word he spoke undermined Eisenhower's own secret plans to disable Castro. As the debates were coming to a close, Nixon suffered yet another blow, this one self-inflicted. On October 19th, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested while conducting a peaceful sit-in at a segregated restaurant in Atlanta. A local judge, eager to settle the score with the civil rights leader, sentenced King to 4 months of hard labor in the state penitentiary. Numerous African-American leaders sought Nixon's help, and White House aide Fred Morrow rushed to write a statement for Nixon to use, calling for King's immediate release. Inexplicably, Nixon stalled, and his press spokesman issued a no comment to the media. By contrast, Kennedy moved quickly. He telephoned Coretta Scott King and expressed his sympathies, His campaign manager and brother, Robert Kennedy, interceded with the judge and got King sprung from jail. It was a stunning sequence of events, one that Nixon badly fumbled. In the following days, hundreds of thousands of black voters deserted the GOP, and they never went back. As the campaign reached its final week, Nixon, who had struggled to overtake Kennedy in the polls, at last deployed his most powerful weapon, one he had been deeply reluctant to unleash. Dwight Eisenhower. The two men had done a curious dance on the question of Ike's role in the campaign. Just a few days after the Republican convention in July, they had met in Newport to discuss strategy, and Ike said he'd do whatever Nixon asked of him during the campaign. But throughout the fall of 1960, Nixon didn't ask. He wished to win on his own terms and to campaign in his own voice. Eisenhower watched from the sidelines, increasingly frustrated over Nixon's inability to rebut effectively Kennedy's charges of drift and decline. He told one Oval Office visitor, "Listen, dammit, I'm going to do everything possible to keep that Jack Kennedy from sitting in this chair." He wrote to Nixon after the first debate that his campaign needed more zip and should be more hard-hitting. But Nixon never found the right way to cut Kennedy down to size. As Ike's staffer William Ewald explained it, Nixon built his campaign on a negative. America has not been standing still. With statistics at the ready, Nixon could prove it. But he was fighting on ground chosen by Kennedy, always counterpunching, always defending, while failing to lay out his own vision for the future. With a week to go and the polls very close, Nixon finally turned to Eisenhower, a 70-year-old man of unsteady health, to sprint the final mile and bring home victory. The reunion began awkwardly. On October 31st, Nixon and Eisenhower met at the White House for lunch, along with Len Hall, Nixon's campaign manager. They planned to discuss an ambitious series of appearances by Eisenhower in the coming days. But according to Nixon, the night before the lunch, Mamie Eisenhower called Pat Nixon to beg that the vice president not ask Eisenhower to do any campaigning. In the previous few weeks, he had been showing signs of strain with high blood pressure and heart palpitations. Mamie feared that a week of strenuous speechifying might trigger another heart attack. With Mamie's tearful plea in mind, Nixon declined Eisenhower's offer to undertake a big swing to Illinois, Michigan, and upstate New York. "Mr. President, you've done enough," Nixon responded when Ike asked how he could help. Eisenhower looked like somebody had thrown cold water over him, according to Hall. Nixon recalled Ike was hurt, and then he was angry. Eisenhower did not know about Mamie's personal request, and according to Nixon, he seemed puzzled and frustrated by my conduct. So he was. Ike called Hall after the lunch and asked, "What the hell's the matter with that guy?" Eisenhower nonetheless carried out his long-planned appearances in New York City, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh in the first week of November, and once again demonstrated the effect of his personal magnetism. On November 2nd, he arrived in New York City for a ticker tape parade down Broadway with Nixon at his side. Perhaps 2 million people lined the avenues as the caravan made its way to the New York Coliseum, where Ike spoke to thousands of delirious supporters. He gave the kind of speech Nixon could not, an appeal that drew on his own deep experience, his life of public service, and his sheer mastery of the complex issues that he had faced as president. With his distinctive style of humility mixed with confidence, he pointed to the successes of his administration, which had ended the Korean War, avoided further conflicts, strengthened the armed forces, halted communism's advance, built up alliances, and expanded the U.S. economy while carefully husbanding the nation's money. "The past 8 years have been the brightest of our history," he insisted, and he defied anyone to match that record. 2 days later in Cleveland, before more adoring crowds, Eisenhower denounced Kennedy's criticism of America's achievements and mocked the claims of this young genius to know better than the Joint Chiefs of Staff how to run the military establishment. To the crowd of Buckeye faithful, he likened Kennedy to an Ohio State football player who spent the season on the bench running down the team and saying, "You are a second-rate bunch of muckers," but then asked to be made head coach. In Pittsburgh the same day, Eisenhower depicted Kennedy as immature, untested, and unreliable. "It was time," he said sternly, "for some woodshed honesty. Promising more programs and more government would cost too much money and trigger catastrophic inflation. These wizards in fiscal shell games," Ike declared, "are idolatrous worshippers of bigness, especially a big government. Furthermore, the nation's security could not be entrusted to a neophyte who needed on-the-job training. In times of crisis, the president alone must make the decisions. He cannot turn to a brains trust or a warehouse of trick phrases." To journalist Theodore White, Eisenhower's speeches seemed crisp, fresh, and dramatic, especially after Nixon's corny, saccharine style. According to White, "Ike had the most sought after and yet rarest of qualities in politics. He makes people happy. No cavalcade I have followed in the entourage of any other political figure in this country has ever left so many smiling, glowing people behind as an Eisenhower tour." The 70-year-old hero, with his cherubic pink face, drew from the crowds a yearning burst of cheers of the kind Nixon never received. James Reston noted the same phenomenon. "Pinch hitting for Mr. Nixon, Eisenhower is now the central figure in one of America's favorite scenes. The old pro coming off the bench and swinging for the fences for the last time." 5. But the hero struck out. When the results of the vote on November 8th were finally tallied, Nixon had lost by 112,000 votes, the narrowest loss of the 20th century, and still one of the closest elections in American history. On the morning of November 9th, Ike and his son sat silently in the Oval Office. The president slumped in his chair, staring vacantly out the window. "I rarely saw him so depressed," John wrote later. "All I've been trying to do for 8 years," he finally said, "has gone down the drain." John insisted he get out of Washington and down to Augusta as quickly as possible, and almost physically shoved him into his car for the ride to the airport. Instead of greeting Nixon on his return to Washington from California, Eisenhower left behind a personal note. Explaining his hasty departure, he said he was feeling a great need to get some sunshine, recreation, and rest. He tried to find a silver lining in the election results by suggesting that Nixon would undoubtedly have a happier life during these next 4 years, since he would not have to handle the difficulties of being president, a statement that anyone who knew Nixon could never believe. The letter could not hide the deep pain Ike felt at that moment. As soon as he reached his presidential plane and sat down in the company of his specially invited golf and bridge pals, Cliff Roberts, Bill Robinson, and Ellis Slater, he blurted out his real feelings. "Well, this is the biggest defeat of my life." Even 5 years later, as he wrote in his memoirs, Eisenhower called Nixon's defeat the principal political disappointment of his presidency. What went wrong? Above all, Kennedy proved a gifted presidential candidate. He won voters with his charisma, his youth, and his style, combined with his intelligence and his central argument that wise and active government could better serve the needs of the people than the penny-pinching, restrained policies of the Ike age. His choice of Lyndon Johnson as his running mate helped him win across the South, though the margin in Texas was only 46,000 votes. Kennedy also persuaded voters that America under Eisenhower had become stagnant and needed a new cause and clear direction to realize its great potential. His advisor and friend Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., believed that Kennedy's relentless emphasis on the gap between America's achievements and its promise worked. He wisely decided to concentrate on a single theme and to hammer that theme home until everyone in America understood it. understood his sense of the decline of our national power and influence and his determination to arrest and reverse this course. He did this with such brilliant success that even in a time of apparent prosperity and apparent peace, and even as a Catholic, he was able to command a majority, though such a slim majority, of voters. Kennedy made the election about the future, about dreams and possibilities, and about greatness, and Americans thrilled to his dynamic vision. And yet the margin was so close that Nixon would be tormented for years by what Theodore White called an interminable series of ifs. If he had worked harder to court African Americans, could he have swung Illinois to his camp? If he had abandoned the black vote altogether and courted the white South, as Goldwater would do in 1964, could he have won South Carolina, Texas, Missouri, or Arkansas? What if he had not done so poorly in the first debate? What if he had used Eisenhower earlier? What if he had done better in framing a vision of the future rather than offering to continue the age of Eisenhower without Eisenhower? What if he had been a warm, personable man of exuberance and charm instead of a brooding, paranoid introvert? The questions cannot be answered. Although the defeat belonged to Nixon, Eisenhower must bear some responsibility. Eisenhower's principal weakness as president lay in his failure to transfer his personal popularity to his party. His effortless and massive victories in 1952 and 1956 allowed him to believe that the country had ratified his ideas, when in fact they had chiefly welcomed his personal qualities of optimism, decency, and experience. During his time in office, his party imploded. In the elections of 1954, 1956, and 1958, Republicans lost a total of 68 seats in the House and 17 seats in the Senate, a devastating verdict from the electorate. In 1960, with Nixon as the standard-bearer, the Republicans clawed back one Senate seat and 22 House seats, but Democrats still enjoyed huge majorities in both chambers. Eisenhower never found the new young leaders who could rebuild the party on a solid foundation. He mused about forming a modern Republican Party, but never threw himself into the task. In 1960, the Republican cupboard was bare, in part through Ike's neglect. Then, too, there was Eisenhower's mistrust of Nixon. The infamous remark in the news conference, "If you give me a week, I might think of one," may have been a lapse, but it told a deep truth about the relationship. William Ewald explained the problem well. Eisenhower did not so much wish victory for Nixon as he wished defeat for Kennedy. When he went into battle in the last week of the campaign, Eisenhower fought to defend his own record, not to clear a path for Nixon as his successor. Ike never believed in Nixon and did not particularly like him, and he was unable to keep his feelings hidden. Nixon's loss stung. For 2 weeks after Election Day, Eisenhower played a great deal of golf and bridge and engaged in lugubrious post-mortem discussions with his friends at Augusta. Even after this long rest, the defeat still felt bitter. "I felt like I had been hitting the solar plexus with a ball bat, especially in the first few days," he wrote a friend. "But now my normal optimism has taken command." Not quite. He stewed over the election results. On November 30th, he called Attorney General William Rogers to say that he was very much disturbed about continuing allegations of fraud in the election. According to Ann Whitman's notes of the call, Ike said he wanted the federal government to exercise whatever rights and responsibilities were inherent in the situation. He admitted that the election was a closed issue, but he felt we owed it to the people of the United States to assure them that the federal government did not shirk its duty. Rogers, a close confidant of Nixon, replied that the FBI was working on the matter. Rumors and accusations of fraud began on election night and emerged chiefly from Chicago. One local Republican election official announced that 10,000 Republican voters had been wrongfully purged from the voter rolls there. Right after the election, Senator Morton, national chairman of the GOP, called for a recount in 11 states where the vote had been extremely close. Nixon dissociated himself from the effort in a press release on November 11th, but 2 days later the chairman of the Cook County Republican Party, Francis X. O'Connell, asserted that professional vote thieves had stuffed ballot boxes and stolen votes, swinging Illinois to Kennedy. Since the official tally gave Kennedy the edge there by only 8,858 votes, the issue looked serious indeed. On November 15th, the vote counting in California finally concluded, and Nixon narrowly won the state, making the margin in the Electoral College even closer. If Illinois and Texas had switched columns from Kennedy to Nixon, the vice president would have won the election. On November 19th, the Justice Department announced that it had ordered the FBI to investigate complaints of voter fraud. Attorney General Rogers seemed willing to use his authority to launch grand jury probes and hold up the voting in the Electoral College, scheduled for December 19th. Nixon discouraged Rogers when the two met at Nixon's hotel in Key Biscayne, Florida, on November 20th. Nixon did not show any zeal for a prolonged legal wrangle. Even if he could have reversed the election, it would have come at a high cost of personal and partisan acrimony and might well have crippled his presidency. More likely, Nixon knew, he would lose any challenge to the election results and only mar his reputation. He would look like a sore loser and damage his future political prospects. Even though Eisenhower lent his support to Senator Morton's continuing efforts to expose irregularities, as Morton put it, Nixon dropped the matter. But he never forgot. William Ewald recalled vividly Nixon welcoming staffers to his Washington home just before Christmas with these words, "We won, but they stole it from us." Chapter 20. A New Generation. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. 1. 2 minutes before 9 on the morning of December 6, 1960, Eisenhower strode out onto the north portico of the White House, stopped at the top of the stairs, and stood rigid in a brown suit and brown felt hat, as if at a funeral. The 70-year-old president bore a dignified countenance, grave and preoccupied. An honor guard drawn from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines lined the driveway to the White House, and a Marine band stood at the ready. The White House gleamed under a fresh coat of paint. The newly blackened wrought iron railings and lampposts sparkled. Across Pennsylvania Avenue, the president could hear the hammering of carpenters who were erecting a large reviewing stand. The nation's leading officials and public servants would gather there to watch the inaugural parade on January 20th. The president remarked, "I feel like the fellow in jail who is watching his scaffold being built." At 8:59 precisely, a cream-colored limousine arrived at the northwest gate of the White House, bearing the man on whom the world's attention had been intensely focused since the morning of November 9th, when his election victory was announced. As the car slowed to a stop, the door precipitately opened. President-elect John F. Kennedy, lean and tan, holding a gray hat in his hand, leaped from the door of the still-moving vehicle, his momentum carrying him swiftly up the stairs in a few athletic bounds. "Good morning, Mr. President," he cheerfully exclaimed. The glow of victory, youth, and destiny radiated from the 43-year-old. Eisenhower, caught off guard by this rush of vitality, reached out, shook the proffered hand, and mumbled, "Senator." The two men paused for the photographs, then turned and walked into the White House together, a somber Eisenhower and a smiling Kennedy. This could have been a difficult, tense encounter. On the campaign trail, Kennedy had laid it on thick, accusing Eisenhower of failing to meet the global communist threat with sufficient zeal. In accepting the Democratic nomination for president in July 1960, Kennedy had painted the Eisenhower years as a lost era. "There has been a change, a slippage in our intellectual and moral strength," Kennedy said. He called on Americans to leave behind men of Eisenhower's generation who sought only the safe mediocrity of the past. To JFK, the age of Eisenhower had been bland, unimaginative, and sclerotic. Privately, Kennedy jeered at Eisenhower, calling him the old asshole to members of his entourage. Kennedy told Arthur Schlesinger Jr. that Eisenhower was a terribly cold man. In fact, he is a shit. Kennedy may in fact have believed some of the caricature he drew of the president, but if, as he arrived at the White House on December 6th, he expected to find Eisenhower dim-witted and distant, out of touch with the realities of governing, he was deeply mistaken. Eisenhower brought the president-elect into the Oval Office and over 2 hours treated him to an astonishing tutorial that ranged across domestic policy, economics, the governing structure of the National Security Council and Cabinet, military security, and world affairs. In a far-reaching briefing, Eisenhower pulled back the curtain on the powers and preoccupations of the presidency. He took control of the meeting from the outset, spending some time on the structure of the National Security Council, the setting for the most important weekly meeting of the government, as well as the Defense Department. Kennedy, eager to show that he was well-briefed, referred to a recent Senate proposal to reorganize the Pentagon. Eisenhower urged Kennedy to avoid any decisions on reorganization until he had studied carefully the activities of the defense establishment. 8 years of patient study and long drawn-out negotiations with Congress and the armed services had made major changes to national defense. Eisenhower wanted Kennedy to take time to assess these changes before making alterations. Eisenhower's call for patience applied also to the Cabinet and White House staff. Both bodies were carefully designed to serve the needs and interests of the president, so he could make decisions based on the best information possible. Eisenhower told Kennedy that it was vital to have a chief of staff who could coordinate the flow of information to the president. Kennedy would later show himself allergic to this sort of hierarchy and careful structure. He believed in a loose flow of information, people, and ideas. His watchwords would be flexibility and improvisation. He would have no chief of staff. In fact, Kennedy seemed uninterested in structure and pressed Eisenhower for details about personalities like French President Charles de Gaulle, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. Eisenhower knew them all, of course. He had worked closely with the first two during the war, while Lieutenant Kennedy was skippering a torpedo boat in the Pacific. Eisenhower was cautious in characterizing these men. He knew Kennedy would have to take their measure one by one on his own terms. He did allow that de Gaulle was a difficult ally at times, but insisted that NATO was crucial to American security and prosperity. He urged Kennedy to think through the possibility of sharing nuclear weapons technologies with American allies. Then he shifted to Reagan and spoke for 20 minutes on the growing problem of America's unfavorable balance of payments, an issue close to his heart. The United States was spending too many dollars overseas, partly the result of a large U.S. troop presence in Europe. Since the dollar was still pegged to a fixed exchange rate for gold, these dollars could be cashed in for U.S. gold by European banks, so the United States was facing a drain on its gold reserves. Eisenhower suggested that the balance of payments problem had to be addressed by asking the NATO allies to pay a greater share of their own defense. He spoke freely without notes. The meeting between the two men ended after 1 hour and 45 minutes. They then walked to the cabinet room where Secretary of State Christian Herter, Secretary of Defense Thomas S. Gates, Jr., and Secretary of the Treasury Robert B. Anderson, along with Eisenhower's Chief of Staff General Wilton B. Persons and Kennedy's Transition Director Clark Clifford, joined them for an additional hour and 15 minutes of briefings on foreign affairs, national security matters, and economic issues. President-elect Kennedy was obviously impressed by what he found in the Eisenhower White House. He spoke to reporters afterward and was gracious in his thanks to the president for his effort to assure an easy transfer of power to the new administration. But privately, Kennedy said even more than that. "Eisenhower was better than I had thought," he later confided to his brother Robert. "Ike had a strong personality, and JFK could understand, talking to him, why he was president of the United States." Of course, the Kennedys, like many later historians, would never truly respect Eisenhower. They viewed him as belonging to another age, without the imagination to grapple with the dawning world of the 1960s. John Kennedy felt Eisenhower was a non-president, according to Clark Clifford, because he did not effectively use the powers of the office. Clifford also admitted that all of Kennedy's staff looked on Eisenhower with something bordering contempt. Yet on this day, as Kennedy sat with the outgoing president, he could see that the old general was more than just a numbskull, a pachyderm, a dinosaur. He demonstrated his mastery of detail and could effortlessly conduct a briefing on a wide array of complex issues before a sparkling, supremely confident Kennedy, who had been devouring briefing books for a week in preparation for this meeting. The two men were worlds apart in their personalities, their styles, and their political philosophies. There was little warmth between them. They offered one another simply the dignified respect due to the office of the presidency. But at this meeting, though Kennedy's star was shining and Eisenhower was now yesterday's man, Eisenhower dominated the proceedings. He showed, and Kennedy perceived in him, the attributes that had made him such an effective leader for the previous two decades: assurance, careful accumulation of detailed knowledge, and above all, a habit of command. 2. Foreign crises preoccupied Eisenhower during his final weeks in office, and while he dutifully kept Kennedy informed, he still made key decisions that would shape the choices available to his successor. One problem, the source of later headaches for President Kennedy, was Laos, a small Southeast Asian nation that mattered to the United States because of its geography. It shared a long, sinuous border with Vietnam. Laos had been declared neutral by international agreement at Geneva in July 1954, and an uneasy standoff prevailed between the Royal Laotian government and a communist movement called the Pathet Lao, which was loosely aligned with the North Vietnamese. The Eisenhower team had been watching Laos carefully for years, nervous that its government was too soft in its handling of the communist threat in its midst. They saw Laos as a vital buffer state. Were it to fall under North Vietnamese influence, South Vietnam, as well as Cambodia and Thailand, might be imperiled. The Americans opened up an economic aid mission in the capital, Vientiane, and sent significant military aid there in hopes this would embolden the government to take firmer steps. The CIA also set up a program to arm and train the Hmong tribes in northern Laos, who were ardently anti-Vietnamese. In 1959, though, as the North Vietnamese stepped up their infiltration of South Vietnam, Laos became a dangerous zone of great power conflict. The Americans, desperate to halt the slippage of Laos into the communist camp, supported a right-wing coup in December 1959 that brought Brigadier General Phumi Nosavan to power. Phumi's position was always weak, and during 1960, he fought against dissident factions in the army as well as Pathet Lao communists. In November and December 1960, much to Eisenhower's alarm, the Soviet Union launched a major airlift of supplies via Hanoi to the Pathet Lao. Ike sent U.S. Air Force bombers from Taiwan to Thailand in case they were needed to support Phumi. In mid-December, Phumi began a major campaign against the neutralist and communist forces around Vientiane and secured control of the capital. Eisenhower personally ordered that a bonus of 1 month's pay be doled out to Phumi's soldiers to maintain morale. A new pro-Western government now held a tentative grip on power and immediately sent out a request for American military aid. The Pathet Lao was licking its wounds and gaining more supplies from North Vietnam and seemed poised to reopen a push to take Vientiane and perhaps seize control of the country. When Alan Dulles reported to the NSC on December 20th, he predicted a strong communist reaction to Phumi's victory and said, "The present anti-communist government in Laos would require extensive outside assistance to survive. To openly aid the government, however, would invite an equally vigorous Soviet response." On the last day of 1960, Eisenhower had a somber and anxious meeting about Laos with key members of his security team. CIA reports suggested that Pathet Lao forces were on the move out of North Vietnam and appeared to be planning to seize control of the country. Eisenhower stated simply, "We cannot afford to stand by and allow Laos to fall to the communists." He was prepared to deploy the 7th Fleet and the Marines to forestall a communist attack. The Joint Chiefs declared their readiness with the aircraft carrier Lexington in the Gulf of Tonkin, airborne troops at the ready in Okinawa, and a fleet of C-130 transport planes ready in Bangkok. Eisenhower, the man who had built a reputation on avoiding entangling conflicts, seemed prepared to commit U.S. troops to battle in Southeast Asia. He directed Ambassador Tommy Thompson to tell Khrushchev that the United States viewed the threat to Laos very seriously and that, in the event of a major war, we will not be caught napping. Eisenhower reiterated his position. "We must not allow Laos to fall to the communists, even if it involves war, in which the U.S. acts with allies or unilaterally." Invoking the domino theory a few days later, he insisted, "If the communists establish a strong position in Laos, the West is finished in the whole Southeast Asian area." The day before Kennedy took the oath of office, he came to the White House again, chiefly to discuss Laos. Eisenhower seemed to relish the opportunity to show Kennedy just how much power the commander-in-chief possessed. He walked Kennedy through the procedures to launch a nuclear attack, drawing on the satchel filled with orders applicable to an emergency and carried by an unobtrusive man who would shadow the president for all his days in office. He also went into a detailed discussion about the acute Laos crisis with Secretary Herter. The Soviets had launched an airlift to supply communist fighters in Laos. The North Vietnamese were helping. Kennedy asked Herter directly if the United States should intervene if invited to do so by the Laotian government, and Herter unequivocally said yes. Some 12,000 U.S. troops could be transported into Laos in 2 weeks from Okinawa. It was the cork in the bottle. If Laos fell, then Thailand, the Philippines, and of course Chiang Kai-shek would go. Eisenhower concurred. Kennedy dictated a memorandum of the meeting showing the impact of the discussion on him. "I came away from that meeting feeling that the Eisenhower administration would support intervention. They felt it was preferable to a communist success in Laos." Clark Clifford believed the discussion had enormous significance. Eisenhower, with his vast experience in military affairs, firmly invoked the domino principle and insisted that this tiny backwater nation suddenly held the key to America's position in Asia. The mood was grim, Clifford remembered, and the conversation marked a real turning point. Eisenhower's portentous tone had a powerful effect on Kennedy and all others in the room and cast a shadow over the early decisions on the next administration. The dark assessment of the Laos problem and Ike's clear support for a military intervention there to counter a communist offensive influenced Kennedy's early thinking, not just toward Laos and Vietnam, but also, most immediately, toward Cuba. 3. If Eisenhower was prepared to fight a war in faraway Laos in the waning hours of his presidency, it is not hard to imagine how strongly he felt about the Cuba problem festering just off the coast of Florida. The centrality of Cuba to the 1960 election only fed the fires of his impatience. Indeed, the evidence shows that in his final weeks in office, Eisenhower dramatically increased the scope and tempo of the covert operation against Castro. As of the fall of 1960, the subversion plan, which focused on infiltration of small sabotage teams, seemed bogged down. Small groups of guerrillas had been sent in, but most were rounded up by Castro's militia. Airdrops went astray. Radio communication with the infiltrated teams was non-existent, and there was no hope that such small-scale efforts would trigger internal uprisings against Castro. At the start of November, CIA planners concluded that a strike force of as many as 3,000 armed and trained fighters would be needed to stage an invasion of Cuba, seize and hold a lodgment area, and begin military operations in conjunction with guerrilla warfare teams. Such a force would require air and naval support on a substantial scale. On November 3rd, The 5412 Committee convened for a wide-ranging review of the Cuba operation, led by National Security Advisor Gordon Gray. Covert operations of the type originally envisaged, they agreed, would not be effective. Castro had tightened his grip. A popular uprising against him was unlikely, and time was actually working on Castro's side. Gray now took the unprecedented position that the only way to clean up the situation in Cuba was with an overt invasion of the island by U.S. military forces. He even floated the idea of using Cuban exiles to launch a fake attack on American forces in the Guantanamo base, which would create a pretext for a U.S. invasion. This idea was quickly shot down, but Livingston Merchant, the State Department representative on the 5412 Committee, inquired whether the CIA had plans for direct positive action against Fidel, Raúl, and Che Guevara. Without these three, he said, the government would be leaderless and probably brainless. General Charles Cabell, the deputy director of the CIA, reared up against such talk, saying such operations were highly dangerous and beyond our capabilities. Either he did not know that Richard Bissell was deeply engaged in a series of plans to assassinate Fidel, or he lied to his colleagues. The discussion reveals the frustration senior planners felt about the lack of results of the CIA's efforts against Castro. In the midst of this reevaluation of the anti-Castro plan, Dulles and Bissell traveled to Florida on November 18th to meet with President-elect Kennedy and brief him on the operation. In Dulles's account, Kennedy said that if Mr. Dulles believed it to be in the U.S. interest to proceed with the project, he had no objection. But what was Kennedy assenting to? The project was in flux, expanding from an infiltration and sabotage operation into a full-scale invasion. Kennedy's presidency would clearly be shaped by Eisenhower's decision on Cuba. Eisenhower began to assert more personal command over the operation in a meeting with his top national security team on November 29th. He expressed his unhappiness about the general situation and thought the Castro threat to the Caribbean and Latin America looked like it was beginning to get out of hand. He went to the heart of the matter. Are we being sufficiently imaginative and bold, subject to not letting our hand appear? He wanted results. We should be prepared to take more chances and be more aggressive. According to Bissell, Eisenhower made it clear that he wanted all done that could be done with all possible urgency and nothing less. Coming just 3 weeks after the bitter election in which Eisenhower had been caricatured as inactive and timid in his handling of Cuba, these words reveal the degree to which he wanted to make a lasting mark in his final few days in office. He had something to prove. Eisenhower's message moved quickly down the chain. On December 8th, the 5412 Committee convened a meeting to review the beefed-up operation against Cuba. Around the table that day sat General Edward Lansdale, now seconded to the Defense Department to work on Cuba, Tracy Barnes, one of the key men behind the 1954 Guatemala coup, and now Bissell's deputy at CIA, Jacob Esterline, chief of the special CIA branch WH-4, that was running the Cuba plan, and Marine Colonel Jack Hawkins, a World War II and Korean War veteran with extensive guerrilla warfare experience. Over the course of the morning, the men laid out the details of the ever-expanding plan. Their plan called for an invasion force, spearheaded by a well-armed brigade of Cuban exiles, trained by the CIA at their Guatemala base camp. The plan initially envisioned an amphibious force of 600 to 750 men. But that number nearly doubled as the date drew near. It would be accompanied by an air bombardment of extraordinarily heavy firepower. Preliminary strikes would be launched from Nicaragua against military targets. The strikes plus supply flights would continue after the landing. This assault force would seize a landing area, draw dissident elements to our own force, and quickly trigger off a general uprising. This scheme looked nothing like the infiltration plan of March 1960, with its small teams of guerrillas and use of anti-Castro radio broadcasts. The CIA now envisioned an amphibious landing of hundreds of armed Cubans arriving on American-supplied ships and landing craft and supported by significant air power. The Eisenhower administration had not worked out the details yet, but the CIA had its marching orders and was putting into place a much bolder scheme to topple Castro.